Today is Wednesday?
Thursday.
Thursday. Thank you. Today is Thursday, April 27th, 2023. This is part 8 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Charles Gary Ladd. And Gary spells his last name L-A-D-D. My name is Tom Martin, and today we are in the comfort of Gary's kitchen with the sun shining through the windows here on a lovely day. The wind is not blowing, and very nice. Yeah. Gary, last time the interview got you to Page, and you had mentioned a well-known photographer that you had met before coming to Page named Tad Nichols, N-I-C-H-O-L-S. I think is how Tad spelled his last name. Can you, before we talk some more about Page, can you tell me some more about your experiences with Tad?
Yes, I knew of Tad's name, and right now I don't remember where I first came upon his name, but it was connected to Glen Canyon. Kind of surprised I don't remember what that first connection was, but I knew his name, and I was familiar, even though at the time I was living in Tucson, I was familiar with the Museum of Northern Arizona, and I was a member at the time, and I got a notice from the museum that it was offering a one-week course in photography in which there were several instructors. And I don't remember the names of all of the people who were involved as leaders or instructors, but Tad was among them. Philip Hyde also was among them. And I was familiar with his name because he was the photographer of the book Slick Rock that was written by Edward Abbey. And Mark Gady was another of the instructors, and he was a photographer that worked at the museum. And Mark Middleton was another name. I think he also worked at the museum. And there was also another photographer who lived in Flagstaff, and I think he was a dentist at the time, but he also was a photographer. I can't remember his name. But there were a lot of people involved, and it was a really interesting offering, so I signed up for it. Drove up to Flagstaff, and we spent a week taking pictures and having photo sessions at Grand Canyon, Zion, and Bryce. And I got to meet Tad, and he was a terrific guy and a really, really nice fellow. And it led to me occasionally, not often, but occasionally seeing him in Tucson. And also eventually it led to me writing the afterword in his book about Glen Canyon.
Wow.
But that was many years later, not too long before he passed away. But it started out with that week-long trip where we traveled in vans between those three parks.
So this would have been 78, 79-ish?
Yeah, I would guess 77.
Okay.
But I might be off by about a year.
Okay. And this was clearly in the day of roll film. So you would go to a location and take pictures. Would you then try to get them developed so you could look at your pictures and how they worked and what to figure out what you could have refined to make them better?
We didn't have that ability on that trip. For me, besides, I think my main purpose on going on that trip was meeting Tad. But also, this was before I was using a 4x5, and it was a chance to see a 4x5 in action, which I don't think I had done up until that time. And I knew that Philip Hyde used a 4x5, and I knew that Tad did. And also this dentist and photographer, I knew he did also.
Okay.
So it was my first exposure to that format. And it would have eventually led me to go to Los Angeles and work with Bill Miller, who I may have mentioned earlier. Bill Miller was a friend of Bill Schoening's, and Bill Miller took me around to various camera stores in L.A. So that I could make a decision on which 4x5 to purchase. So that would have been a year later, I think, so maybe 78. Mm-hmm.
So, knowing nothing about 4x5 cameras, how many models were there, and what kind of decisions were you having to make? What are the differences in these cameras?
Well, this is a long time ago, and I don't know if I can fully answer that, but the main differences were whether I wanted a metal camera, which would be more sturdy, or a wooden camera, which would be less sturdy but lightweight. And because I expected to backpack with the camera, that it was kind of a foregone conclusion that it would be wooden. And that really brought the decision down to two or three cameras. So I think there was a Toyo and a Wista and a Tachihara. That may have been what ended up as the three choices that I selected from. And they were all, you know, I'm not sure about that choice, that those three choices, but they all would have been fine. And the one that I chose, which was the Tachihara, it's the one that I stuck with all of the time that I used a 4x5. And I kind of wore them out after several years. The movements got more and more sloppy and less and less likely to hold their positions. So I think I had three during the 25 or 30 years that I used a 4x5.
So what kind of camera were you using before then? And what did the 4x5 do to your photography that the previous camera could not do?
Well, mostly I was looking for quality. I had always, well, for a very, very long time, I had been using 35 millimeter. And I had been using Nikkor mats, so the Nikon system. But I didn't feel like it was necessary for me to have the absolute top-of-the-line Nikons to take pictures. I was using Nikon optics, but not the cameras. So Nikkor mats, which were just not as sophisticated, and that was fine, but the film was 35 millimeter, which meant that the film was an inch by an inch and a half, pretty small, and very good for most things, but the 4x5 was 4x5 inches, so much larger, so you could make prints that were much larger and still hold quality. I don't think I really understood when I went to 4x5, though, that by doing this, it was a whole new way of thinking about photography, because it was much more expensive and it was much slower. And rather than looking through the viewfinder and seeing the image right side up, you're looking at it upside down. And that at first is very disconcerting. And I can remember carrying the camera and going on a hike and not being very happy with the weight of it, not being very happy with how slow it was, and not being very happy with the image being upside down, and not being very happy with the whole thing. Now, I'm not saying that that was always the case. I'm not saying it was almost insurmountable. I'm just saying that at times I was not real happy with the 4x5, because there were other times when I was thrilled with it. And once I understood that that upside down image, which you get used to it after a while, actually, you don't even think of it as upside down. And in a way, it helps you compose, because it allows you to see the composition without the interference of seeing it in the standard way. You're seeing shapes instead of seeing reality. So you get used to it, and in a way, it actually is better. So it's both good and bad, and I feel like I feel like I can, trying to be honest, that after having used that camera from 1978 until 2012 or whenever it was, that I got pretty good with it. And I really miss using it. And when, even today, after having not used it for quite a while, if I see some potential image, the first thing I think is, wow, that needs a 4x5. And then a millisecond later, say to myself, Gary, you're not using a 4x5 any longer. So even if the image today deserves a 4x5, I don't have that camera anymore. I still am thinking that way. But today's cameras are terrific. But I miss investing the time and the work that the 4x5 required. I don't really like just snapping pictures the way we do today.
So a couple things. Not knowing anything about photography, it sounds like the difference between the 35 millimeter and the 4x5, if I could put it into today's camera terms, it would be pixels, meaning the 35 millimeter doesn't have as many pixels for the same image that the 4x5 would have for the same image.
That's true.
Based on the negative size.
Right. But there's more to it than that. Okay. When I started taking pictures with a digital camera, I tried very hard to convince myself, you know, really this isn't so different than using film. I tried very hard to convince myself that that was the case. And that's not the case at all. It's not just a different technology. The other thing is, it has the ability to record a much wider range of brightnesses. And that, I understood that to some degree, but what I didn't understand was you can use that to really change what is in your photograph. With 35 millimeter film, transparency film, you can really only record 5 f-stops of brightness. You could go from absolute black to absolute white and only record 5 f-stops in brightness, each f-stop meaning doubling the brightness. With digital, you can do 12, 13, 14, 15, and that makes a huge difference. Because with film, I would look at a scene and I'd get out a light meter and I would say, well, I really like this scene, but the brightness range is too much for me to record. I shouldn't even bother with it. Don't even stop here and bother with this. Keep hiking and see what else I can find. But with digital, I can record that scene. And it also means that I can take pictures under much lower light conditions and under much brighter conditions. So it opens up a whole new world of photography. And I didn't understand that at first. And there are other repercussions, too, that are wonderful. But I still miss film photography, so because I got very good at it. You get good at something, and then a new technology comes along, and then it's not important that you were good at it. So I miss that.
You know, Gary, you mentioned that the 4x5 compared to the 35 millimeter roll film camera is slower. And how do you mean that? Is it just, you know, pushing and turning a lever in the 35 versus the 4x5 has more things to do?
Yeah. If I'm backpacking and I see something that I want to photograph, at an absolute minimum, it takes 15 minutes to take a picture. Because I take the backpack off, I pull the tripod out. The 4x5 does require a tripod. Unfold the camera, put the lens on it, pull out the magazine or the bag that has the film holders in it. Compose the picture. Often that means adjusting the angle of the lens, the tilt, and so forth. Put the film holder in, pull the dark slide out, take the picture, put the dark slide back in. Usually I would take 2 different exposures because often, because the film is really fragile, it gets damaged, it gets scratched, especially on a backpacking trip. So if one of them gets damaged, then I've got a backup. And then to put everything away. And all of that, 15 minutes, is if things go well.
Wow.
If the wind is blowing and there's something in the foreground that's moving around, grasses or leaves or branches, then I have to wait for that to get better. Or if I don't like the arrangement of clouds, or if there's a contrail in the scene that I want to move out of the way. So it's very time consuming. There are all sorts of things that will slow it down. But with digital, I don't worry about contrails. I can remove that. If there's some idiot standing in my picture out there who wasn't there when I started to set up, I can remove him. So,
you mentioned you need to wait for the wind to stop for a minute so the grass isn't moving. Does that have something to do with the speed of the camera or the fact that the camera is big enough that the wind could be shaking the camera, or both?
Both, yeah. The camera is big enough that it's easily shaken by the wind. So just the night before last, I was down at Glen Canyon Dam, and the wind was howling down there. And I was using a digital camera, but it was on a tripod, and I was having trouble with the wind.
Wow. Okay. So would the bigger camera just be worse?
The bigger camera, much bigger camera. Yeah, on it.
And yet on this trip with Tad and Phil and these others, they were all using 4x5s, and they were they encouraging the people that were in the class to really think seriously about 4x5 to enhance their photography, or were they very accommodating to the 35mm?
Oh, yeah, they were helping in any way they could. They weren't trying to convince anyone to use a 4x5. They were just trying to aid anyone's photography, no matter what format.
Okay.
Phil Hyde was a terrific guy. Although driving through the tunnel at Zion, he kept hitting the curb, which was... I was in his van at the time, which it's one of the moments that I remember more than any other moment on that trip was Phil kept hitting the curb in there. That tunnel, of course, is very narrow, and I was glad to get out of that tunnel with Phil. So one of the highlights of that trip that week. But so, Phil was a really nice guy, just like Tad.
Before we talk about Phil, let's talk a little bit more about Tad. Did Tad talk to you about his experiences in Glen Canyon before the construction of Glen Canyon Dam?
Well, some, yeah. I don't remember the specifics, but that was one thing I was hoping that would happen, yeah.
Okay. All right. And he was photographing in Glen Canyon at the time when he was there, before the dam as well.
Sure was,
and
yeah.
And 4x5 using?
I think he was using every format that he could, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. And do you remember what specifically about photography that you might have learned from him?
No, I don't. Okay. You know, I don't remember any details about learning anything about photography except for this fellow who was the dentist. We were set up at Greenland Lake, which is on the North Rim. It's a lake that has not been a lake for years now. It's on the way out to Cape Royal.
Okay.
Maybe this year, after such a wet winter, maybe it will have filled up with water again. But we were set up there, and this fellow... let me use his 4x5 and to even take a picture. I never saw the results of that photograph, but to go through the motions of tilting the lens to try to set the depth of focus to match the situation and then close the shutter in preparation for inserting the film holder and then pulling out the dark slide and then making the exposure. You have to learn that sequence, otherwise you ruin the sheet of film by having exposed it inadvertently before you're ready to.
Yeah. Okay. So then if you did that, you would take the picture, but the film had already been burned.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, if somebody is standing there while you're trying to take a picture and they're messing up your concentration, that's something that happens years and years later after you know better. So, or should know better.
Huh. You mentioned that you were living in Tucson at the time. And Tad was living in Tucson. What do you remember about Tad, about his house? just about visiting with him in Tucson?
I may have visited him only once.
Okay.
But I remember about where that house was, and it was on a dirt road at the base of the Santa Catalina Mountains, kind of on one of the roads parallel to Swan. And it was on the west side of that road. And I remember...
So way out east side of Tucson? No, but not that. So this is in the Catalinas. This is north side of Tucson.
Yeah.
North central in a way.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. But near Swan.
Okay.
Maybe west of Swan.
Okay.
Maybe Campbell area.
Okay.
And the house was on the west side of whatever street it was.
Hmm.
And he had a big reproduction, I think, in his dining room, maybe of a Monument Valley scene.
And, huh.
That's all I remember.
Okay.
But he was just a very, very nice guy.
Hmm. Nice. And then you mentioned that you had a chance to work with him on one of his book projects.
Yeah, Images, Glen Canyon, Images of a Lost World, or I never quite get that title correct, but some of his friends, after decades of Tad always saying, someday I'm going to put together a book on Glen Canyon, but he never got around to it.
Mm.
Some of his friends got together and said, Tad, we are coming to your house and we are starting on this book project and we are going to do it. And it's going to start next week and we're going to have the book underway by December and it's going to be printed in June.
Wow.
And it's going to be on the bookshelves in August. And and that was roughly 15 years ago or 20 years ago. Yeah, and the book's still available and it's a wonderful book.
Mm.
So I was asked to write the afterword for the book, which was a real honor.
How did you approach that with Tad having seen Glen Canyon before the inundation from the dam? And you hadn't seen that, but you knew it through his photos and others. But you knew the new Glen Canyon, if you will, the Glen Canyon formed by Lake Powell, the reservoir behind the dam. How did you approach that?
For the afterword?
Yes.
Or, yeah. Oh. Well, I haven't looked at that afterword in a while. I don't know what I said.
Okay.
have we touched on this at all? Okay. Stop me if we've covered this before. I became aware of Lake Powell through a National Geographic article that came out in 1964, I think, maybe a little bit later than that. And I was astonished at this landscape. Now that's before I knew anything about this area. It was my introduction. And then when I started running the river with Martin, in 1970, all I heard from the people on that trip was how horrible the loss of Glen Canyon was. So I was bathed in this attitude of how miserable Glen Canyon Dam was and the loss of Glen Canyon. And so I automatically hated Glen Canyon Dam and Lake Powell. And I first saw the lake in 1971 and started visiting this area shortly after I moved to Tucson in 72 and was, of course, very impressed with the area surrounding the lake. And as I may have mentioned earlier, when I first came here, when I first moved here, I wouldn't even take 4x5s of the lake. It was just not worthy of taking 4x5s. But Jim Devenny and Bill Shaning and I and some others, we were going into some of these really fantastic areas that surrounded the lake, especially, I may have trouble remembering the names here, but Chowle Canyon, tributaries of Navajo Canyon.
Okay.
And also, when I started rowing the lake in 1976, the lake became, even if I didn't like the lake became access to some of these areas that surrounded it. And gradually, it happened over quite a number of years, I began to like the lake itself. It wasn't just access. The lake was pretty amazing in itself. And today, kind of ignoring the fact that the lake is very low right now, I think the full Lake Powell, or nearly full Lake Powell, it was just an amazing thing. It was unbelievably beautiful. Mm. And also ignoring what it destroyed. Lake Powell was just staggeringly beautiful and interesting.
So you have to write this. You have to concisely write about this for Tad, who had seen Glenn when it was staggeringly beautiful without a reservoir.
I don't know what I said. I really don't remember what I said. I only remember that I started out by saying, what is it that makes Glen Canyon so unusually appealing? And it's the curves. And it's so unlike Grand Canyon downstream. It's the curves. And I thought that was insightful. Not brilliant, but... It's so obvious. It's just these beautiful curves in mostly the Navajo sandstone. And when you think about the Salat Canyons, it's the curves. And when you think about the way the river curves left and curves right and curves left and curves right, it's the curves. Yeah, it's so, you know... Katie Lee was not happy that I had anything to do with Glen Canyon.
Hmm.
She told me that, literally, the words she used, you should not have anything to do with Lake Powell. Not Glen Canyon, with Lake Powell. But I don't think I really actually said this to her, but I felt like, well, Katie... You didn't save it for me. I should be mad at you. And all I'm doing is appreciating what's left. This is what was left to me. And the lake is fabulous. And, you know, today we're trying to decide what to do. Should we go ahead and drain it because it's down to 25% of its full volume? Is this our chance to drain it? Or should we try to save it by conserving more water and not everybody using quite so much? I'd like to either see it fill up again or I'd like to see it drained. Either one of those would be okay with me. I don't think it's too good the way it is. not at 25% of its full volume. And I don't know.
This is really, really fascinating to me because I've been trying to understand Glen Canyon before the dam through historic photography, rematching and looking at those images. And sort of understanding that Glen Canyon can be viewed as an incredibly, staggeringly beautiful place full of water or empty of water. That's really interesting to kind of ponder and think about. Let's switch gears to Phil Hyde for a minute, someone else who was on that week M&A photography tour. Where was Phil living at the time? What do you remember about him? And did you develop a friendship with him?
I didn't, and that's kind of a shame. He lived in Northern California, and he was involved in a lot of conservation projects, I believe. Kind of lost track of him. I can't say a lot about him. Okay. I just know that I liked his photographs in the book Slick Rock, and I thought that was a terrific book. I'm kind of sorry it's not still around. The text by Edward Abbey was really interesting, and the photographs were great.
Okay. So it sounds like that week-long journey with those photographers was very instrumental for you, because when I think of your photography, I think of Gary in a 4x5.
Yeah, I think that was a very important week. I got to meet Tad, which was the main reason why I took that course, and it set me on the course of getting a 4x5, and pretty soon I drove to Los Angeles and spent a day with Bill Miller. If I haven't mentioned this before, Bill Miller and I'm having trouble with another name, but another astronomer at Kitt Peak spent a lot of time in Navajo Canyon and White Mesa, doing archaeological research connected to, I think, the Museum of Northern Arizona. And they're the ones who first understood that the ancestral Puebloans recorded the Crab Nebula explosion in 1054.
Oh, wow.
And Helmut Abt is the name I'm trying to remember. And the Chinese recorded it, but the Europeans did not. And it's felt like the Europeans did not record it because it did not match their concept of the heavens as being perfect and unchanging. But the ancestral Puebloans recorded it as a crescent-shaped moon and a star-like or explosion. And it was the beginning of what we call the Crab Nebula.
Okay.
And there are a couple of petroglyphs or pictographs in the Navajo Canyon area. And maybe one of them is on White Mesa, or maybe not. But anyway, Helmut and Bill Miller found one of them, and then I think Bill Miller independently found another, and others have been found at other places since then. But Bill Miller was the head of photographic work at Mount Wilson and Palomar Observatories. But he helped me out by just driving me around L.A. for a day and looking at different cameras.
Do you remember how much that 4x5 cost you, the first one you bought? You needed a tripod, yeah. You needed other things for it?
Yeah, the camera was $400 or $500
at the time.
Wow. Yeah.
That was a lot of money in those days.
Well, yes and no. You know, my Nikkormat camera was $200, and kind of the average Nikon lens, if you didn't go very big, was about $200. So the 4x5 camera was kind of expensive, but the lenses could go up in price quite quickly.
And I'm assuming that the Nikon lenses wouldn't fit on the 4x5?
Not the 35mm lenses, but Nikon did make lenses for 4x5s.
Okay, so now you're needing not only just the camera body, just the 4x5 body, but the lenses that go with it and the holders and the blah, blah, blah.
Right. But you can also buy used 4x5 lenses. That was very common.
Okay. Okay, so that was helpful. At least to try to control costs a little bit.
The film holders were expensive too, and you needed a lot of those, and they were bulky, which made it hard for backpacking.
So a film holder then holds a negative.
Two to each film holder.
Two?
Front and back, yeah.
Oh, okay. But then you have to have that in some sort of box or something, especially if you're backpacking, so that you don't crush it or hurt it.
Well, they were really sturdy, so you wouldn't crush it.
So the holder was sturdy.
Right.
Okay.
And then, I'm not sure when this happened, but let's say 1995, some companies came out with some very delicate film holders that could be inserted into a sturdy film holder, so you only had one sturdy film holder. I've forgotten what these things were called, but they were terrific. They cost more, but you could carry a whole lot more film because they
would sort of all line up in this one box instead of one box with two negatives in it. And you'd have, you know, for 10 boxes, that's only 20 pictures.
It was just a way to carry a whole lot more film in a much more compact way.
Okay.
Because you were only carrying one really sturdy film holder that was inserted into the camera over and over again.
Oh, okay. So for a backpacker, that would be very...
It was a miracle.
Wow. Okay. Okay, so we've talked about Tad and Phil. Let's come back to Paige and your early explorations around Paige. Can you talk about that for a while?
Sure. Yeah. How are we doing on time?
Let's see what the machine's doing here. We've been going about 45 minutes, so we're good.
Okay. All right. Well, one thing I want to mention for sure, I was thrilled to be living in Page. I had spent some time around here. This was like heaven. I should also point out that when I moved to Tucson, it was like heaven also, having moved from Missouri. Missouri was like heaven after moving from Ohio, but in Page it was like heaven, and one place that I had been in already before I moved here was Antelope Canyon, and I'll come back to that in a minute, but here in town I had a two-bedroom apartment. And shortly after I moved here, a friend of mine from Tucson, Joan Cusick, was moving to Denver, and she stopped here, and we explored around a little bit. And one of the things that I had looked at on topo maps that I hadn't checked out, but we did when she was here, was we drove south on 89 out of town, and I had noticed on topo maps that there was this interesting bend in the Colorado River, and a little hill off to the side of the highway. And I thought if we just parked along the highway and we would be adjacent to this hill, we could walk over that hill and down to the edge of this bend in the river. Well, we drove out there, and I was surprised to find that there was actually a road that started right there and went over the hill. And I had at that time, an International Scout four-wheel drive. And we took that road up and over the hill, and it went right to the end of that bend. And there was no such name at the time, but that became Horseshoe Bend. And nobody in town knew about it, as I later found out.
Gary, who do you think did know about it? Who was driving over that hill to go look at it?
Yeah, I have no idea.
Huh.
So I knew some people in town. I don't remember if I've mentioned Ada Hatch and
you
Jim
have.
Merrill.
Okay. You have.
Well, Ada had been here for, I've forgotten, 10 years or 15 years at the time. And she knew people that had been here since the dam had been built. And no one that Ada knew, including Betty Mays, who had been here since 1958, or Harry Gilliland, no one knew about this place. And so I have no idea who had driven that road or put it in. And of course, even if no one had been on it for years, it still would have been there, because it's just sand and going through black brush, and black brush doesn't recover once you kill it. It doesn't come back. So I don't know who had been on it. But it was a great overlook, and we were out there by ourselves, of course. And at the time, I didn't have a 4x5 lens that was wide enough to take in that whole view. But I don't remember the timing here, but I did eventually get a lens that was wide enough. And it took several years, but I started taking elder hostel classes out there. That was quite a few years later. And I took friends out there. Betty Mays had become blind over the years. We took her out there, and she didn't know anything about it. But for years, no one, we never saw anyone out there. And I don't think I fully appreciated. I know I did not appreciate how other people would appreciate it. And I've got notes that I kept. I kind of have a logbook from those years. And all I said in the logbook was, we drove out to the edge of the Colorado River opposite P. Mesa, which is the mesa that the P standing for Page, that's south of Page. So it didn't have a name. Now that name would have come from Michael Fitali. Now he's a photographer that moved to Page a few years after I did. And think I've kind of half gotten this confused, but the first picture that I had published from there, I think, was on the cover of a phone book. It may have been a KC Publications book on Glen Canyon. But I had people were calling me asking where that was. And Michael figured out where it was, and he took a very nice picture of it and called it Horseshoe Bend, and that's the name that stuck. I wanted it called Tad Nichols Overlook, but that did not go, unfortunately.
It is fascinating today, driving to your house for this interview. There's a large entrance station, three lanes open, three lanes full of cars today, good 30 cars in the parking lot. On a spring day, sort of in the pause between spring break and when school gets out. And it's busy over there today. So really fascinating to think about getting the little international scout in four-wheel drive and going up over the hill and down the other side and getting out, and there's nobody there.
Yeah, it's changed completely, and the rest of the story is that people started going there after we published pictures, the pictures that I took and the pictures that Michael Fatale took. Michael ended up opening a gallery here in town, and more than anyone else, he popularized both Antelope Canyon, I think, and also Coyote Butte and Horseshoe Bend. But he also had no limits. He did some things that were very bad. And in we discussed this at all?
No.
Okay, well, in Arches National Park, he had an Arizona Highways photo workshop there. And when you have these photo workshops, you have to make out a schedule about what you're going to do. And the back in the offices in Phoenix, they go through the schedule and make sure that it makes sense and it doesn't violate park rules. And Michael changed it, and he decided that they should do a photo session at night. And he bought some aluminum pans and Presto logs and started fires in these pans after dark. And unfortunately, those logs, I guess, get very hot, and they melted the aluminum. And the aluminum and the material that the logs were made out of got into the rock.
Ooh, that's a kind of waxy kind of stuff in those
grease
logs.
Or something.
Yeah.
And you know, this was quite a while ago, and I don't remember exactly what happened. They also collected some firewood from around the area and built fires to keep warm. And they left it kind of a mess. And the first people up there in the morning reported this. And I don't know how this happened exactly, but I had a photo workshop at the same time, but it was in Grand Canyon. I was also doing Arizona Highways photo workshops. And when I got home, I got a phone call from the Park Service here at Glen Canyon. They have been called by park personnel at Arches asking if they would check on what I knew about this damage that had been done by fires and arches. And I got this phone call, and I said, well, I don't know anything about that. And Oh, weren't you up there doing a photo workshop? And no, I had not been. So somehow there had been some miscommunication, but that was the first thing I had learned about what had happened. But I didn't know who was responsible, but it was Michael. And they charged him or threatened to charge him with a felony. And the FBI got involved, and they actually got into his files to see where he had been taking pictures in the past, because it turns out that some fires similar to those had been built in Canyonlands.
Oh, wow.
And he had been responsible for those, too. And so he, as I said, I don't remember everything about this, but he was forbidden to go into those parks for a certain length of time, and he was fined some amount of money, and it was a disgrace. And Arizona Highways will no longer use him again, and he has done he's done a number of things that some of us are not at all happy with. So he no longer has a gallery here in Page. That's been gone for a long time. He no longer lives here, and that's a good thing. Anyway, we're all happy that Michael Vitale is no longer here in Page.
Where did he go?
He moved to Zion or Springdale for a while. And,
okay.
But he opened up other galleries, and he even he opened up a gallery in Moab, and when he was unable to rent a space that was too close to Tom Till's gallery, because it was owned by the same landlord, he threatened Tom Till, actually threatened him, told him there would be trouble.
Wow.
I don't, the guy is just nuts. And, and the word is he somehow got involved with a mob in Las Vegas.
Oh, my gosh.
I don't know.
Huh.
But
huh.
Anyway, he's responsible for the term Horseshoe Bend, which I think is
okay.
Unfortunate. But he's left a trail of disaster. And in fact, are you familiar with the balanced rocks that are in Waweep Canyon?
No.
Okay, well, there are some spectacular, beautiful balanced rocks, conglomerate boulders that are sitting on top of these thin...
Penitente kind of things?
They're...
So there's a sort of a hard geological cap rock, and this underlying formation is very susceptible to erosion, so it will taper in, so you'll have a rock sort of on a very very slender pedestal.
Very slender white pedestals.
Wow.
They're beautiful things. And I was certainly not the first to see them, but a friend of mine who is a pilot told me I needed to see this place, and we flew over them one time at a very low level. And then I hiked in there, or actually for a while you could drive in there, right up the bed of Waweep Creek, and which was kind of dangerous because you could sink in the mud if you weren't careful. But anyway, Michael asked me where these things were, and by that time I was aware that this guy was had no limits. He didn't know what he was going to do next. And I was vague about where it was, but pretty soon we were both represented by the same gallery in Sedona at the time. And he kind of copied one of my pictures of that location. Hmm. And I had not taken this picture down to that gallery yet. And so when I took it down there, they said, oh, this is just like Michael's. So, which annoyed me a great deal. Hmm. Anyway, I was going into this place frequently at the time. And one time I went in and a fire had been built right next to this pedestal.
Oh, wow.
And this was before this revelation of what had happened in Arches.
Okay.
And I couldn't understand why somebody would build, you know, it looked like a campfire. Why would you build a campfire on this little narrow ridge? There was no place to sit. I mean, well, that was probably Michael.
You build it for backlighting or front lighting, some night photography.
I guess. I mean, I don't know if it was Michael, but it mm-hmm. probably was.
Okay.
Anyway, the guy just left a trail of stuff like that behind him. And he pulled all sorts of tricks here in town on people that he asked for favors from them and then never paid them or never... Guy was a disaster. And it's nice that he's gone elsewhere, but...
You mentioned Antelope Canyon and Coyote Buttes as other sort of scenic knock-your-socks-off places around Page. And I wanted to ask you about those places because you mentioned Ada Hatch and other locals, Harry Gilliland, who didn't know about these magnificant natural attractions that are worthy of national park status in their own right. Was that the case as well for these other areas that the town didn't seem to know about them?
The town did know about Antelope.
Did.
I think they knew about that very soon.
How so? How do you think they discovered that? Just kids playing and let's go over there?
Yeah. Here's another name I'm not going to have trouble coming up with, but there's a woman who lives here in town now who has moved back rather recently. She said they used to take horses out there and go into Antelope Canyon all of the time.
Huh, okay.
It was just one of the places where they played around. And it was called the Skinny Caves at that time. That was known way, way back. It was just one of the places where they played around.
And it is on the Navajo Nation. It's outside the yes. Page City boundaries.
Right. But I don't think anyone paid any attention to that at the time. The boundary was invisible. Yeah.
Okay. But it was a good place to get out of the sun on a hot day and get in some shade and explore around.
Right. And the really steep sandbanks that were on either side before you reach Antelope Canyon, the upper Antelope, those were just really fun to go up and down in a four-wheel drive. And I don't think the landowners were too happy about that, but...
You mean people were just taking their four-wheel drives and just going right up the hillside, chug up the steep sand dune?
Yeah.
Okay.
The wind, you know, just blowing the sand over the top kept them really steep.
Hmm. Okay.
Well, I can't think of her name right now, but she was here from... as a kid from way back. Hmm. So Antelope was known immediately.
When was the first time you got in there and how did you know to go over there?
Well, when I first started coming here, which would have been 75, I think, there was a Park Service brochure on Glen Canyon that had a picture of Antelope Canyon
oh, wow.
in it, even though it was outside the park. I don't think anyone paid much attention to that fact at the time. And I've, you know, if you went down to the visitor center, there were some very knowledgeable park people there at the time. Devin Smith was one of them, D-E-V-I-N Smith, and another fellow whose name I don't remember. I learned a lot from those two, and one of them would have told me about Katie Lee's record, Folk Songs of the Colorado River.
Okay.
Devin, I think, is probably the one who told me about Antelope Canyon and how to get there. And when I first went in there, which I'm pretty sure would have been 75, but it might have been 76. For the first few times that I went in there, no one else was there.
Wow.
And, you know, looking back on it, you just don't appreciate at the time how wonderful that was. You know, you just assumed it's always going to be this way. And then when it's gone, you think, oh, man, what an idiot I was not to have come in here more often.
Mm. Did you start taking photos in there then right away?
Yes, yeah.
And when you got your 4x5, were you right in there again with the 4x5?
With the 4x5, but man, taking pictures in there with the 4x5 was very, very hard. Yeah, the problem is looking up means that the ground glass is looking down. So in order to look at the ground glass, you've got to be down on the ground or straining your neck looking upwards at the ground glass.
Huh.
So it's very awkward. The other thing is, when you're in there and if there's any kind of breeze blowing at all, which is usually the case, there's just this light sand blowing down on you all of the time, and that gets on the film and it scratches it.
Oh, wow.
So I still have them. I didn't ever throw those 4x5s out, but they didn't make it into my regular 4x5 archives. A lot of images were damaged by the sand because you just can't keep it off. It's just falling like tiny snowflakes on you in Antelope Canyon all of the time.
So would that be, I mean, I almost kind of want to wash out my mouth with soap before I ask you this question. Would that be something you could digitize, that negative, and then attack with Photoshop to get rid of this scratches and sand grains?
Yep. I'm glad I kept those because they could be saved today.
Interesting. Yeah.
Another thing about Antelope Canyon is that when I moved here in 81, there still was essentially no one going in there. But it was on the verge of changing. And I'm not sure if I quite have this straight, but pretty soon the landowners or the Navajos began thinking that they should charge people to go in. And I don't remember exactly when that happened, but let's say 82 or 83, 84, right in there, really soon. And I think it was, I just don't remember exactly how this went, but it was like $2 to go in. But there were people who complained that it was too much, especially if it was cloudy, because then you didn't get the light beams and you didn't get the reflection off the walls that turned the light red. So then they'd give you, I've forgotten how this worked exactly, but it was like they'd give you back $1 or something like that. But also, right in that period of time, Lower Antelope Canyon, which you could not just walk through. Have you been in there, Tom, lower?
I have not.
Well, it's a series of drop-offs. And it's much different because you go into it by dropping down into a little slot. You just weasel your way down into a slot. And at first, you can work your way down. But pretty soon you come to a drop-off that's too big. You've got to have a rope, or for a while there was a metal fence post that had been bent, and it was wedged between the walls, and you could tie onto this fence post and go down a rope. And somebody had carved in steps in some places, and you could use those.
Wow.
So there were all of these kind of half marginal ways of getting down. But I don't think I ever went all the way through. I had come up from the bottom. One time coming up from the bottom, there was a rope, and it wasn't a very good rope. And I had pulled on it and tested it and thought that it was okay, and I climbed up the thing, and it had been pulled down but had gotten stuck, and it was just, you know, just barely stuck between, stuck in a notch or stuck some way. Anyway, one time I was at Lower Antelope, and there was a guy there that had, I don't know how he had arranged this, but there was a group of five or six Germans who had agreed to pay him $100 each to take him in there. And I watched this transaction, and I did just as you did. My mouth was open. And this is 1985 or something like that. And another thing that happened was that a Navajo guy decided, okay, I'm going to make some money off of this. He bought some aluminum ladders, and he tied ropes to them. And the idea was he would put these aluminum ladders in with those drop-offs, take the ropes up to the top, and be prepared to pull them out when there was a flash flood. Well, that worked until he misjudged when there was going to be a flash flood. And I talked to him one time, and he said, well, yeah, I didn't get back fast enough, and it tore out, I remember very little about this, but he said one of my ladders, it was a 30-foot ladder, and it had worked its way down while the flash flood was in progress, and it was only 6 feet of it sticking out.
Wow.
And he said it was too expensive, so we started digging it out, and we couldn't find any more place to put the mud and the sand, and we finally had to cut it off.
Wow.
That, you know, you don't realize that at the base of the drop-off, that it drills a hole.
Yeah.
That's so deep, and that, you know, that's probably where that missing body or bodies are from the 1998 or whatever it was flood. And he said, And I said, we couldn't get any more of that ladder out. There was just no way we could get that deep.
Amazing. Huh. Yeah, don't think about it when there's a pour-off in a slot canyon. You got to ask yourself, well, how did this 100-foot deep slot get here? Well, through water action in floods. And so when that water gets a chance to kind of go over a drop, then it burrows, just drills right on down into the soft sandstone. Which makes me think about the dam and the dam construction in the 50s into the early 60s, and how the people working on the dam realized right away they needed to protect the sandstone from the water of the river, and they did that with concrete. It was very, very fascinating. So that's an interesting connection that I hadn't made. Huh. Huh.
I'm telling you, when I do think this dam, because of those spillways, is really vulnerable. If any little place begins to erode and starts the cavitation process, once it starts, it just eats away so fast. And it's just a bad design. And you know, compared to Hoover, with all the different ways the water can go through that good rock, this one is just too simple and really vulnerable rock.
Yeah. Maybe this is a good time to put a comma in this interview series. And next time I'm going to write down, we'll pick up with Coyote Buttes, which is the last, another amazing place nearby that we haven't talked about yet. Is there anything else what we've talked about here today that you wanted to go into more that we haven't? Tad and your 4x5, Phil Hyde, Horseshoe Bend, Michael Fatale, Antelope Canyon.
Not that I can think of. I thought we were going to finish up today.
Finish up today. You haven't talked about 1983. You haven't talked about your hitchhike trip to the Grand Canyon. So we're not done yet. With that, Gary Ladd, thank you so very much for a wonderful interview. Today is Thursday, April 27th, 2023. This will conclude part 8. Of this Grand Canyon Oral History. My name is Tom Martin, and Gary, thank you so very much.
You're welcome.